Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is Election Eve special coverage on NPR News. We're talking about the campaigns and the candidates, the issues and turnout. And we're giving you some last-minute information about voting. If you have questions about polling places, early voting, anything like that, NPR's Angela Davis is taking your questions and getting the answers. You can send your questions to Facebook or Twitter at Angela Davis NPR. You can ask a question on the live blog, right, Steph? You're sending
some
of those over. Mm-hmm. Okay, where's the live blog?
It's at nprnews.org, our homepage, right at the top.
All right. In a moment, you're going to hear an excerpt from last night's Senate debate at the Fitzgerald Theater between Karen Housley and Tina Smith. But we're turning first to NPR political reporter Brian Baxt. Brian, I know you are super busy. Really appreciate the time. Thanks for coming in.
No problem.
Housley and Smith have had quite a number of last, 11th hour debate matchups. You were there to listen. Tell me what you took away. What's like the central conclusion from watching that?
Well, first of all, it was like none of the other debates we heard this year because they actually let each other answer. They weren't talking over each other. There was not that macho feel. But I mean, this was a race that was late to develop anyway. The seat didn't open up until January when Tina Smith was appointed to the Senate. And then Karen Housley was pretty much the only Republican candidate who stepped forward, or the main Republican candidate who stepped forward. And this race hasn't been part of that national conversation, that national picture, you know, in the fight for the balance of the Senate. There's been some money that's come in late. But that's not to say that the race is suddenly more competitive. It just means perhaps that the Democrats are trying to ensure that they get a victory here. And there's also so much money out there. And as these other races get closed out or near closed out, it's got to shift somewhere.
Okay, I think what you're saying is important here, because we did hear about the last minute spending that was going on in this campaign. You're saying the campaigns for, like, the DSCC, some of these party campaigns have a lot of money. And so as they're looking in other places in the country where they don't have to spend it, let's put it there in Minnesota.
Yeah. And I wouldn't put, you know, entirely in the money here, but the money's a good thing to follow because the parties have a lot of information about where these races are at. And they're putting the money where they think they have the best chance to either flip a seat or they think that they need to shore up a seat. And we saw a lot of Democratic money come in last week, about $1 million. It's not much in the scheme of what's happening in other parts of the country, but the Republican money didn't necessarily follow. If the Republicans really felt like they had a strong chance for this last push, they would have also put some money in. But who knows? I mean, turnout, nobody knows what the turnout's going to look like. Yeah. and how it's going to affect any of these races up and down the ballot. There's just so much volatility in the electorate right now.
We did a show last week about the power of incumbency, and I want to make this point because even though Tina Smith has been in the job, as you know, she didn't get in the job until a couple months into 2018. So she really hasn't had the power of the incumbency as we would normally see, has she?
And she's been in the minority party, so she hasn't really had the chance to kind of move major legislation or do as much, say, as Amy Klobuchar has, who's been there for so many years and built up these relationships. But I want to also make the point, Amy Klobuchar is on the ballot. The last times Minnesota has had the two Senate seats on the ballot, it hasn't split its vote. They've gone one direction. And right now, Amy Klobuchar is in pretty good shape. So you think that she might have
good.
Well, she's in very good shape. But, you know, for Amy Klobuchar standards, she might not have a, you know, 25 or 30 point blowout. It might be something, you know, high teens, low 20s.
I think we ought to talk about that dynamic, though, that you just mentioned, why it is that when you have somebody at the top of the ballot in a Senate race, that can flow down to another Senate candidate, why that's powerful for the other Senate candidate.
Well, absolutely. And she hasn't really been pushed in her campaign. So she's had, she has
Amy Klobuchar.
So she's had a ton of money and she's had time to kind of build up these local infrastructure, you know, for her, which, you know, when those people go out to knock on doors or communicate with voters, they're also saying, and did you know that so-and-so is also in a tough race? Would you help them out?
Right. We're going to talk about the governor's race here a little bit later, but Is a dynamic that you've just described helping Tim Walz or helping, well, I guess it would be Tim Walz since Jeff Johnson doesn't have two incumbents right at the top in those seats?
You know, the governor's race has always been a little bit different, and that's because, you know, people feel like this is the person that they're going to be living with for the next 4 years, whereas sometimes in the Senate races, I'm going to send you off and you're going to be part of that club out there and hopefully you'll vote in accordance with my wishes or not embarrass us or whatever. In the governor's race, they feel like there's much more of a connection.
And that's because you're in my living room on the local news. I see you at campaign events or I see you in, yeah.
And you're deciding how much money my schools get. You're determining how much I pay in all these taxes that I know I'm going to have to pay. So there's the stronger rooted connection in that governor's race than the Senate races.
Is it your sense that Minnesota is going to end up being the kind of linchpin we are in the House, who controls the House, in the Senate?
The Senate conversation has been in many other places. Many of our neighboring states have had a larger role, you know, with Wisconsin having a somewhat competitive Senate race, North Dakota, of course, with Heidi Heitkamp being put in a very tough position. The Senate picture has largely been around Minnesota. Minnesota hasn't been in that mix as much. Of course, we do have two seats, so you can't count it out. I mean, if something happened or if there's a late surge for Karen Housley, that would obviously affect the Senate.
Would we know? We really wouldn't know that until Election Day, right?
That's right.
At this point, because the polling is over.
That's right. And the president has been here a couple times and had Karen Housley on stage, and he might, you know, send out one of these late tweets to get his people motivated to vote for her. But he hasn't come through in the last week. Mike Pence was here over the weekend, but he went to Wisconsin instead. So Minnesota was, you know, in his sights, but not, you know, one of the main pictures in for him.
Brian Baxt with us now talking about the Senate debate. We're going to hear an excerpt from last night's debate between Karen Housley and Tina Smith. It was moderated by Kathy Werzer. We want to play you some of the debate, and we're going to start with DFL incumbent Tina Smith talking about her approach to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was passed last year.
Let's take a look at this bill that passed before I was in the Senate, and I would have opposed it. 83% of the benefit of that tax bill went to big corporations and the richest Americans. And it's important to remember, it's not as if we had that money sitting in a bank account somewhere, and we said, oh, let's give a tax cut to because we have that money. We're borrowing that money from our children and grandchildren in order to pay for that tax cut right now. I just think that those are the wrong priorities. And it's concerning when at the same time you hear the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, say that now that this big tax cut, which has caused a massive contributed to our debt, $1.5 trillion, that now we might need to look at Social Security and Medicare as being too expensive because we can't because of the impact of the tax cut. Again, I just think these are the wrong priorities.
Would you vote to repeal this bill?
I would. I think that it's wrong that the middle class tax cuts sunset, but the corporate tax cuts go on indefinitely.
Karen Housley, would you vote to extend the middle class tax cuts?
We have seen, and it's disappointing that I think Tina was trying to say that she doesn't think it's working. 80% did not go to the wealthy. Like I said, we just in October, we've created 250,000 jobs. 250,000 middle class jobs. That helps the middle class. That tax and jobs bill is working. The economy, like I said, growing at 4.2%. And so, I mean, I think it's there is a very clear choice that Minnesotans have. And if Tina Smith is elected, she will vote to repeal and go backwards into where we were before the economy was growing. And so I think the tax and jobs bill is working. Again, unemployment. Companies, they were repatriating money from overseas that they are now bringing back, Apple, and creating 20,000 jobs. And so to really loosen the noose that was around our business's neck when it came to the overburdensome regulations of the Obama administration, it's working. And she said that, you know, the economy is going great and things are working and people are keeping more of their hard-earned dollars in their pocket.
Yet, former Fed chairperson Janet Yellen recently said to an audience that she characterizes the debt path that the U.S. is on as unsustainable because of this deficit. And she says it's going to get worse as more and more baby boomers retire and spending on health care programs grows. And she said, if I had a magic wand, I would raise taxes and cut retirement spending. So what are your ideas to deal with this mushrooming deficit?
Well, you're right. There was a lot of spending in there, and I've got my little grandson here, and that's who I worry about. That next generation, like Tina said, and we have to slow our spending. The economic growth, the 4.2%, is going to help. But we definitely have to curb our spending. We've been on a spending spree, and it's not, we don't need to introduce more taxes to pay for it. We have to curb our spending.
And, of course, that leads me to this question. Would you like to rebut this here? And then I want to ask about where you would cut. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think that the big Republican tax cut that went through at the end of the last year has increased the federal debt by 17%. That's $1.5 trillion of money that we did not have that we've given back in tax cuts. This is not my opinion, that went 83% to the biggest corporations and to wealthy people. I think those are the wrong priorities.
So as you then look at this, again, mushrooming deficit, and you're saying that we're spending too much, where would you cut, Senator Housley?
And it's funny, every time we do these things, that's I think the moderator or the interviewer at the station always wants me to pick like one program that, oh, I picked this and this is what I think we should cut. And that's not it. It's just, it's even if you're doing your household budget at home and you know you have to cut your costs by 10%, you don't just say, I'm just going to stop buying food. You say, oh, you know what? Maybe I have to cut a little bit here. Stop going to Starbucks. Stop going out to eat. Maybe not go to the movie. So just trimming a little bit in each area, but not cutting one big program. And then again, even in the state Senate, when I got there, especially coming from the private sector and owning my own small business, to see how many duplicative agencies they are that are in government and government waste, and one department doing the exact same thing that another department is, being the chair of the Aging and Long-Term Care Committee, seeing that the Department of Human Services was doing duplicative services that the Department of Health was doing when it came to taking care of our aging, and neither one of them was talking to each other. So those kind of things really need to be looked at. Government spending, bureaucracy, like let's start there.
Is that enough, do you really think? I always hear this, too. I've been around too much, too long, probably. You know, I hear candidates say that, you know, I'm going to look at trimming waste in government, right? But that's not going to make up this deficit. So, I mean, when I ask you where you would trim, yes, you gave me that answer, but we're spending a lot of money on Social Security and Medicare and other really big programs.
Well, I know what the answer is, and it's not to increase taxes. It's not because every time you increase taxes, then they go and spend it even more. So it's we definitely have to take a look at the spending and what is inefficient and what isn't working. Programs sometimes continue to get funded year over year, and nobody even checks to see how that program is doing to hold them accountable. So like really getting your hands dirty and looking into all of that, but do not raise taxes so you can continue to spend more.
Senator Smith,
could I answer this question?
Please, yes, exactly.
I think it's a really important question. And I think that it takes some specific ideas to figure out what to do about a problem like this. And so here are three things that I think that we could do that would help to bring, that would be specific places where we could find savings in the federal budget. So the first would be accomplished by a bill that I proposed that's very similar to a bill that Senator Klobuchar has proposed, and it says let's allow Medicare to negotiate directly with the big drug companies for lower prescription drug costs. We do this with the Veterans Administration. Let's do it as well with Medicare. That would save $160 billion over 10 years. So that's specific savings. So that's one thing. Another thing that we need to do is to look for some big projects that just clearly don't make sense, but they kind of have this momentum that continues. An example of that is this, it's called the plutonium oxide disposal facility. It was opposed by the Obama administration, also by the Trump administration, yet it continues. If we stopped it, it would save $50 billion. And then the last thing that we could do is, you know, a lot of the budget, the discretionary budget, is in the Defense Department. Now, I have supported pay increases for our military and increases of the military budget, but the Defense Department did a study that looked at the administrative side of the Defense Department, where there are a million people who are working as contractors, and if this business-led study identified that we could save $125 billion in administrative costs if we followed the recommendations of that study. So my point here is that it's important to have specific ideas about what you could do. And I know from my experience as lieutenant governor and chief of staff in this state that you have to, it's hard to find those cuts. And you have to look under, you do have to look under every rock, but then you have to be looking for something specific.
Senator Housley.
Well, while Tina Smith was lieutenant governor, we did end up there wasn't a tax that she didn't support, and we ended up growing government by 33%. We're now one of the highest tax states in the country. So, and those specific programs that she just meant to cut still wouldn't cover the debt.
But they are at least some starting points.
Well, then there's also, you could also say Medicare has $36 billion of improper payment. 10% of what Medicare pays out are improper payments. So there's another $36 billion right there. But I feel like we're going down this road in Tina Smith's history. It has been whenever the spending got way out of control during her time as chief of staff and lieutenant governor, the solution was to tax to make up the deficit.
You mentioned, Senator Housley, immigration, so let's dive into that. Obviously, that is a big concern. National polling shows that most Republicans are concerned about immigration. Democrats most worried about health care. We'll get to that, obviously. Mm-hmm. What are your ideas, Senator Housley, for looking at immigration in this country? Who gets in, how they get in, how to reform this system?
It is a huge issue, and one of the top two issues in the state when you're traveling around and talking to people. We do have to reform our immigration laws, but we do have to secure our borders. We have to know who's here. Like I told the last group, everybody here in the audience and everybody listening has a story of where they came from. I've got one grandfather from Norway who came to farm up in northern Minnesota, and my other grandfather came from Yugoslavia to work in the meatpacking plants in South St. Paul, but they came here legally and they came through Ellis Island. And the reason that people are storming the borders is because our process takes way too long. There is so much bureaucracy and red tape to get into this country. Even those that are living here can't become citizens. They every 2 years have to reapply for a temporary visa. I was talking to my friend from India, and it's going to take him 50 to 70 years to become a citizen, and that's ridiculous. So we need to reform our immigration laws, get rid of the red tape, and get these immigrants here legally a lot faster.
Senator Smith.
We have an immigration system in this country that is not working. It is broken. And it is imperative that we fix this. And we need to fix it in a way that protects our national security and also is true to our core values. I would strongly support a bipartisan immigration reform package that actually passed the Senate in 2013. It included strong border security, increased support for border security personnel and better technology and better barriers where barriers, you know, make sense, and then also reforming the legal immigration system so that people who have been in this country, who have earned a path to citizenship, who've worked hard, have the opportunity to become a citizen like Dreamers, and then also reform the way the legal immigration system works. So, for example, there's not this long waiting line. E-Verify, which is a way for employers to make sure that the people that they're hiring are eligible to work, and that we reform the way that the visiting and seasonal visa programs work so that our businesses can have the people that they need. And, you know, this is essentially an economic issue, whether you're a dairy farmer in central Minnesota or a big company in downtown St. Paul. This is something you have to we need to fix.
Karen Housley.
And we did have a debate the other night, and it was clear, and I don't know if where in there that you said that, because everything you said sounded really good, but Tina does really support open borders. And the other night she said...
Hang on, please.
It's just not true. I voted for $35 billion in increased border security, and I just said a moment ago that it is a core responsibility of the federal government to protect our borders.
But you had the opportunity to support the bill that was presented to you that would have kept the Dreamers here and secure the borders and get people here legally, and you didn't.
That bill was far from a comprehensive immigration reform package. And, you know, this ought to be a place where we can find some common ground. And I appreciate you saying that what I said makes sense, because I think that it might be that if we sort of put aside this sort of, you know, the intensity right now of the political debate that is attempting to use immigration as a way of dividing us, that we probably could find common ground. And that's why I go back to what the Senate passed in 2013, a strong bipartisan package.
You are hearing an excerpt there of the Senate debate at the Fitzgerald Theater, moderated last night by Kathy Werzer. You can hear the whole debate at noon on NPR News. I'm Carrie Miller. You're listening to Election Eve special coverage on NPR News. We've been talking to NPR's Brian Baxt about last night's Senate debate, and we're going to hear his profiles of the candidates for governor now, Jeff Johnson and Tim Walz. But Brian, bringing you back into this, I have to say, I heard your profiles, and I thought I was learning more about character and what kind of created them as people and as politicians than I typically hear. So I think that was a good thing.
Yeah, and I would encourage folks to go back to NPR's news site because
and listen to it.
And there are actually two profiles on each, one talking about what molded them personally,
right,
and the other one about what molded them politically.
Right.
So,
got it.
So there's plenty of area for you to cover.
What'd you learn about Jeff Johnson on that?
Well, Jeff Johnson, he's kind of had two phases in his political career. When he was first a legislator, he was kind of in the majority, so he was able to work to move legislation through, and he was seen as more pragmatic than people are casting him as now. He's been on the Hennepin County Board and a dissenting voice on that board. He's one of one or two in the minority on a lot of votes. So he's had to kind of reshape his philosophy. Is he going to be the guy who, no matter what, I'm going to tell you what I think and I'm going to vote my principle, or am I going to vote to go along, to get along? Whereas in the past, he was a collaborator on a lot. And you don't get that sense now watching some of the ads or watching kind of how he comes off on the campaign trail.
One of the things that I think came through in your profile, and I think it has come through in the campaign and the advertising that Jeff Johnson has done, is he's not somebody who is a bomb thrower. He's not somebody to take people on with the kind of nastiness that we've been seeing in other campaigns in other states. And I think that's an ethic that's pretty important to him.
He's a very pleasant guy. I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with him over the last, many years. He ran for governor 4 years ago as well.
Right.
And he's a great guy to be around. He answers your questions. He's very pleasant, and you know, he doesn't get up in your face like a lot of the politicians do today. If
truly
they feel like
committed
they're,
to the policy discussion,
absolutely,
too.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. So this is Brian Back's profile of GOP gubernatorial candidate Jeff Johnson.
In the state house, Jeff Johnson had it good. He represented a comfortably Republican suburban district and was in the majority party for all 6 years he served in the legislature. It put him in a prime position to sponsor bills that would become law. Achievements he proudly promotes now.
It essentially rewrote property rights in the state of Minnesota, which essentially ended meth labs in the state of Minnesota. The biggest reform of lawsuit abuse that we've ever seen, or at least in the last several decades.
He was also the chief author of a law requiring businesses to quickly notify people of personal data breaches. And he spearheaded a law to limit access by minors to violent or mature content video games, although that one fell to a court challenge on constitutional grounds. By his third term, he was chairman of the House Civil Law Committee and had ambitions of climbing the political ladder. In 2005, he stood outside the Attorney General's office to launch a campaign for that job.
And I can guarantee you that I will not be in the business of driving good jobs and good employers and good people out of the state of Minnesota in a relentless pursuit for headlines and higher office.
Johnson got trounced in the 2006 election, and for a time, his political career was sidelined. A new door opened when a couple years later, a longtime commissioner on the Hennepin County Board decided to move on. Johnson won the spot. But it wouldn't be like the legislature. Johnson's conservative stances put him in the minority on the seven-member board.
It's a nonpartisan board. So when any board controls $2 billion, it becomes real partisan real quick.
Mark Stenglein served with Johnson early on and supports his current bid for governor. Stenglein says his fellow commissioner was a lonely voice whose ability to drive change was constrained.
Well, you got to get, you know, three other votes to get anything done. So for him to round up three other votes probably didn't happen too often.
Johnson chairs the board's Public Safety Committee, which largely ratifies grants for criminal justice and youth intervention programs. Many of the full board's actions are unanimous, although not always. Now in his third term, Johnson regularly finds himself on the losing side of 6-1 or 5-2 votes. Fellow Commissioner Linda Higgins says Johnson seems to take those defeats in stride, but he doesn't come off as strident.
He isn't really a kind of a guy who rants and raves and throws temper tantrums. That's just not his personality, as I've seen it anyway.
Higgins is backing Johnson's DFL opponent Tim Walz in the governor's race and was hesitant to be seen as criticizing her colleague. Johnson has 2 years left on his board term if he loses in this fall's election. Johnson shrugs off the nickname some have conferred on him, Commissioner No. He says he merely has a different worldview than the others.
But I try to pick my fights.
He need only walk outside the Hennepin County Government Center for a taste of his biggest frustration. Spending for light rail transit. Whenever the topic comes up, he offers a variation of this objection he raised ahead of one critical board vote on the proposed Southwest Light Rail line.
The bottom line for me, I think this is a terrible use of my constituents' money because it's not going to do anything for congestion, and no one has been able to show me otherwise. And until someone does, I cannot support moving any further with Southwest Rail.
In an interview, Johnson acknowledged losing on the issue.
I'm not going to change the minds of six of my colleagues on Southwest Light Rail. And, you know, unfortunately, we're voting on spending more money on that pretty much every other week. So I state my case and we move on, and they're kind about letting me state my case.
If Johnson wins the governor's office next month, he'll be in a position to halt Southwest. And he'll be able to do more than just state his case on a range of important topics.
So, Brian, that was interesting. You got at some of Jeff Johnson's practicality, too, as a politician and a guy who has been, as noted, in the minority for some time. He's learned how to work within that kind of political dynamic.
Yeah, and he's had to use it to kind of, even if he's not going to win, he knows he just needs to, you know, use the megaphone he's got, because people are always looking for, you know, both sides of the view of the argument. And on the Hennepin County Board, if six people are voting one way and talking one way, when you're the guy talking the other way, your voice is heard somewhat as well, even if you can't change the outcome.
Do you get the sense that for Jeff Johnson, this is kind of the apex of the political career? This is something that he's always aspired to, running for governor, being governor, and that depending on which way it goes, you know, he's looking at this is kind of what it was all leading to. And if it doesn't work out, maybe I get out of politics.
Well, Jeff Johnson has had statewide ambition from early on. He ran for attorney general, as a piece noted, in 2006, didn't win. Then he was a top Republican national committeeman. So that kind of kept him in the loop. And then he kind of pushed on and ran for governor in 2014. A lot of people weren't, you know, thinking he was going to get the nomination. There were so many big names in that race, and he grabbed that endorsement, soldiered on. And then when he lost, people were thinking, okay, that's the end of Jeff Johnson. But he just kept going. I mean, so this guy has been persistent, if nothing else.
You've covered Tim Walz for quite some time. He's been in politics for some time. What's the thing you most wanted to know about Tim Walz as you went into creating this profile?
Well, I was, you know, as I mentioned, I did a couple of them, and I really wanted to dive more into this military part of his past. And so I did in that earlier profile, which you can find online. In this one, you know, Tim Walz has also been this guy who was at one point in the majority and one point in the minority. He's tried to make this case in the campaign trail that I'm this bipartisan guy, this coalition builder. And so I wanted to look at, is that really the case? How did you do? How did that? What was the result? Did you get stuff passed, or were you just one of these voices in Washington that goes to cable TV to gripe?
Here's NPR News profile of Tim Walz.
Tim Walz first went to Washington in 2007, the same year as Minnesota's Michelle Bachmann and Keith Ellison. Walls lacked the trailblazing status of Ellison and the cable TV poll that quickly made Bachman a star on the right. That was just fine with Walls. He still remembers the paths for prominence in Congress being laid out during a House orientation. Be an attention-grabbing partisan or a subject matter expert out to make deals.
I heard somebody tell me very early on that the national media is for your ego and the local media is for your constituents.
In Congress, Walls has a handful of laws to his name and a significant role in shaping others. He's the lead Democrat on the House Veterans Affairs Committee, where cooperation is more common than partisan bickering.
In the minority, I found myself being very effective because the Republicans needed someone at times, and there isn't still a piece of veterans legislation that is not sent back to me, even by the majority.
Congresswoman Kathleen Rice of New York says her fellow Democrat garners respect because of his almost quarter century of military service.
That carries a lot of weight. So I think that Tim's service also helps kind of get people to see things in a different way, maybe, than they would normally.
But Rice says Walls also goes out of his way to break down barriers. He helps organize the Morning Congressional Running Club around Washington's famed monuments. Walls prods his colleagues from both parties to join in.
He does not look at things through a purely political lens like a lot of people do. And I think that's what makes him unique. But it's so tempting to kind of get caught up in the political garbage that goes on, and he just doesn't.
Walls says his willingness to work across the political aisle would be an asset if he becomes governor. Walls has broken with the prevailing Democratic position 39 times in the current session of Congress, or about 7.5% of the total votes. That's according to a vote tracker kept by ProPublica. Republican nominee Jeff Johnson argues Walls isn't as bipartisan as he says.
Your voting record is quite liberal. I mean, you were with Nancy Pelosi and Keith Ellison over 90% of the time. I think it's 94%. So this suggestion that you're one of the most bipartisan people there, the bar is pretty low, unfortunately, in Congress right now.
Johnson's remark at a recent debate didn't go unanswered.
Would you have voted with Nancy Pelosi to improve veteran suicide care? Would you have voted with Nancy Pelosi to improve the GI Bill with me? Would you have voted on many of those things that all of you would agree with? This is what's wrong with our system, about finding a voting record in Congress.
Walls lists as his top accomplishment a 2015 Suicide Prevention Act that stepped up mental health programs in the VA. Earlier in his tenure, Walls was heavily involved in closing a loophole that enabled members of Congress and other government officials to buy and sell stocks using non-public information.
A new member of Congress could have said, look, you know, why would I want to upset the status quo? Why would I want to rock the boat?
Former Democratic Congressman Brian Baird of Washington State says Walls stuck his neck out by signing onto his bill to pinch the perk. Walls took a lead role in getting it passed once Baird left Congress. Walls says it didn't endear him to colleagues.
I did get this blowback when people would say, well, yeah, Walls, he wants to do the Stock Act thing because he's poor and doesn't have any stock. He's a school teacher type of thing. And they would say it, you know, half jokingly, but it wasn't jokingly. They were making the point that this guy doesn't get it.
Baird says Walls has the right compass.
Tim is not going to knuckle under. He's not going to be a pushover.
Walls would be the first person to jump straight from Congress to governor in Minnesota since 1978. Another congressman from southern Minnesota, Republican Al Quie, was the last and served one rocky term.
The harder job was governor. There was only one of us.
Quie supports Jeff Johnson, but the 95-year-old says should Walls win, he'd advise him to keep an open door to legislators from both parties, follow his gut, and...
No BS.
Brian Baxt here with us here as we talk about the gubernatorial candidates. I'd forgotten about that, Brian, that stand that Tim Walls took when he got to Washington. Some of his colleagues were pretty upset about that, weren't they?
Yeah, you never want to be the person to take away a perceived perk when you're the new guy, especially.
Exactly. I mean, what does that tell you about who he says he would be as governor?
Well, he says he's going to be this guy who kind of looks out for the common interest or the everyday interest.
They all say that.
They all say that. Yeah. I mean, but he can point to that and say, well, I did it. We'll see if he continues to do that because, you know, he has had a lot of help from kind of interest. You know, the labor unions are in big for him. Is he going to be able to stand up to them?
Yeah.
You know, there's groups out there that have been helping with running ads against Jeff Johnson. Is he going to be able to stand up to the people who funded those organizations? That'll be lots to watch. He has made quite a bit of promises to voters on the campaign trail.
Hey, a question for you about the trajectory. It's interesting when you see people spend time in Washington, maybe as members of the House, look back to their state and think, maybe I could make a difference, maybe I could wield more power as being the chief executive of the state. This is a fairly common thing as you see the arc of people's careers.
But not in Minnesota, surprisingly. Ah. You know, Minnesota, for some reason, doesn't reward the people who go out to Washington and want to come home. You know, I talked to Al Quie in there, which was a pleasure. He's 95 and he's still whip smart and remembers quite a bit. But it's not an easy place to go to because people think you're a creature of Washington. You take a lot of votes, so there's a lot of stuff for your opponents to mine. So the fact that he's been able to come back and get this far is somewhat of a surprise as well.
Brian, good to have you here. Thanks for the time.
You're welcome.
Good luck out there covering the election.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.